Well, this is the talk we've all been waiting for, not for its content, but for its position in the series. In these talks, in a very simple, almost simplistic way, we've been exploring human evolutionary relationships. We looked at things that apply to all relationships, and then we looked at relationships with evolutionary participants whose experience and consciousness is less than ours. And then last evening we looked at relationships with those who have evolutionary experience and consciousness that is greater than ours. Tonight we're going to speak about relationships with equals. And it's probably going to be even more simplistic than all the other ones have been. At this point in putting together the lecture notes, when all of the basic things have been introduced, I usually go back and see how things look so that I don't produce misunderstandings. And when I did that in composing this series of talks, I noticed that there was one thing that was said in such a way that it could lead to misunderstanding. From the way relationship was introduced, one could get the idea that relationship structure was static. At one time, in many societies, it was really static. And for example, in ancient China, it was not only static, but it was codified. For example, there was a clear and strictly adhered to understanding of the relationship with the first brother to the second brother, how they addressed each other, what they spoke about, and things like that. There was a convention for all of that. All of the filial relationships were defined, and it even extended to social and political relationship. That was a time when the racial and cultural spirits were more in control. It was important that people be brought the exact experiences that they need, and those in charge of them saw that they did that. And that was before there was much spiritual individuation. And along with spiritual individuation comes freedom. So things used to be something like that, but they are not that now. Now individuation is accelerating, and the racial spirits, the cultural spirits, and the other things that guide us are falling back. In some cases, I even think it is by intention. We've had several instances in the last 10 or 15 years that indicate that. For example, we had the Yugoslavia fell apart. And some of the countries, like Serbia, wanted to remain in a racial status. Because if everything is done for you and everything is set up for you, it's a kind of a comfortable thing. You fit into a niche. And they tried to do everything they could to force things into that way of looking at things. I actually believe that cultural and racial spirits are being withdrawn to hasten individuation. But when that happens, a lot of the order is lost. The cultural spirits work through the desire world. And so you have the case like in Rwanda. When the cultural spirits were removed, what was left was some very primitive urges in individual desire bodies. This is when you had genocides with hundreds of thousands of people being killed by other people that were of a different race or a different tribe or something like that. So those things are things are becoming more in a flux in terms of relational activity, and it's probably for the individuation of humanity so that we can become one volitionally and not because we are held together by some kind of spiritual cohesive force, but by free expression of spiritual force. Now, this doesn't apply only to human relationships. The fact is that we live in a very dynamic cosmos, and that cosmos has many different kinds of fluid relationships. Some of the relationships are still strict, so strict that we think of them as the ways of nature. For example, if we look at the animal group spirits, every species has its own habits, and naturalists write those habits down and keep track of them. That's a sign that these animals are brought to certain specific experiences so that they can get exactly what they need for the unfoldment of their consciousness. We still even have some of these examples in a nuclear family, in the relationship of the parents toward an infant. The parents are all protective. They are around that child almost 24 hours a day. When the child gets to be a little bit older, then the relationship of the parent toward the child is one of authority and obedience, so that the children learn to be obedient and have built into their developing etheric nature. They get the built-in habits so that when it comes to puberty, that they can get through puberty without too much psychological scar tissue. And when they do get to be come of age, and when they do reach puberty, trying to be authoritative will have disastrous results, and the relationship has to switch, and it has to be a relationship that is much more of a counseling relationship than trying to lay down the law with authority. So all the parties have to change, and all of the parties are changing, and relationships are not static things. I grew up in a very unusual situation. My father tried to be static, but he couldn't. My father had the sun in Scorpio, and he was brought up by very strict parents because he had been an orphan. And if somebody's not your kid and it's just an orphan kid that you're bringing up, you can be a little more strict with him. And they'd give him oatmeal in the morning, and if the oatmeal was lumpy and he wouldn't eat it, when it come to be lunchtime, he'd look down and there was the oatmeal, and that oatmeal was put before him until he ate it, even if it went bad. It was that kind of a thing. And it took in my father because he had Saturn in the 10th house, and he wanted the father-son relation to be like the Chinese relationship type. If I heard it once, I heard it maybe 40 or 50 times in my life. The father is always right. There was no dispute about it. Now, to be fair to him, almost all the things about him were very positive, and he was very generous and very loving, and he was pretty liberal, but when it was his say, it was his say, and there was no questioning. It isn't only in family matters that rigidity used to be that strict. I tried for years, after I began to awaken up, I tried for years to convert our relationship from father, son to friendship, that we were equals, and it didn't take, and it didn't take. And finally, when he began to get older and had needs and couldn't do things the way he did before, he came around. And by the end of life, he was my friend. And it was a very wonderful thing to go through. However, I must say that from time to time, he would still refer to me as the kid. but that probably was good, too, because it chewed away at some of my pride. By definition, evolution means change. And for creatures, as being different from creators, it means voluntary change for the creators. As Christian mystical aspirants, we must be willing and eager to exceed what is demanded by the law. Because in that way, we do everything in life, including the things that are mandatory, the things that we have to do, we can do them by voluntary action, by going the extra mile, because we are free in doing it. That's sort of what freedom means. Max Heindel said something to the effect that adaption is one of the chief principles of evolution. So, relationships change. Some try to hold, and some slide along with the evolutionary pace. So it's not really a simple matter. I guess I got that whole business clear. We've been trying in a very different way to take the way that the Orphics looked at Zeus. The Orphics said that when Zeus had relationships with superiors, that related to one kind of activity in our inward spiritual consciousness in the exercises we do. And when Zeus had relationships with humans, that related to they were his inferiors, that related to another way that we develop our consciousness inside of us. We looked at those in previous occasions, and tonight we'll look at Zeus's relationships with equals and how they relate to our relationships with equals. Zeus came from a big family, and he had cordial relationships with all of his brothers and sisters. With his brothers, they were based on respect, and there was enough potency in each of them to demand respect. After he freed the entire family from the belly of his father Cronos, he became the ruling deity. But with respect to Earth, he shared his reign. The seas and the oceans were all given rule to Poseidon. The underworld was given to his other brother, Hades. Tartarus was the underworld, and Hades was the ruler of it. But those are the brotherly relations. They were kept with comity, you might say. But there was no creation that came from them. The creation came with the sisters. Zeus had sexual relations with two equals, with two of his sisters, Demeter and Hera. Again, we're going to look very fragmentarily at all of these stories, or the little bits of stories that we're going to look at, because we just don't have time to really go into it. Being the Demiurge, Zeus was the generator and fabricator of everything in concrete existence. From the world of concrete thought down through the desire world and the etheric subdivision of the physical and right down to this chemical stuff. And this creativity or this productivity of him was described in mythology as having unbounded lust. His mother, Rhea, recognized this, and she tried to trick him into a vow of celibacy. And he was so enraged that he blew up, and he was going to rape her. And so she transformed herself into a very venomous serpent to ward him off. That didn't bother him. He turned himself into the same kind of serpent and had his way with her, but the union was without issue. Later on, after he overthrew his father and had all of his conjugal relationships with his superiors, the various titans, and in doing that he set the cosmos into order, then and only then did he start looking for a wife. And he sought out his sister Hera, who was extremely desirable to him. But she didn't want to have any part of him. And she just shunned him altogether. Then he got the idea. He knew that she was a sucker for taking care of things. So he turned himself into a bedraggled cuckoo and appeared... anything goes in mythology. And what happened, the cuckoo appeared where Hera was, and she felt so sorry for it, she took it and she held it to her breast. And Zeus transformed himself into his true nature and united with her. And she was shamed. And she was so ashamed, and she was no longer a virgin, that she was forced into marrying him. And the wedding night lasted 300 years. Now, she was the only one that could satisfy his lust. Only one. Everybody else left him, couldn't do it. That's what polarity is like. When you have the perfect opposite pole to yourself, that's the only way that can neutralize each other. All right. There are different versions of the family, but the family of Zeus and Hera usually includes Hephaestus, who is the blacksmith god. Hebe and Ares are also children, and some of them say Eris. Hephaestus was the fabricator. Hebe was the goddess of youth, and she was sort of like a younger generation Earth mother. Ares was a god of war, and his twin sister Eris was the goddess of strife. She started the fights and he fought them. So these were the direct offspring of Zeus and Hera. Now, she was very jealous, and she tried to keep him away from all of his frolics. We talked about one of those episodes yesterday. Obviously, from even this little fragment about their life, we can see there are many, many interpretations and many meanings that are very important, but not within the intent of this talk, as unorganized as it is. It's clear that the offspring of their union represent things that have to do with the desire world. Strife and bellicosity and the desire for youth and all of those kinds of things. And so we can see that the projections through the mind are in the first generation into the desire world, as in this terrible diagram. Zeus was the demiurge. He focused from the region of ideational thought And he projected through the concrete mind everything that is in concrete existence. Now, this is not the part of the fragment that we're interested in. We're interested in the relationship just with his wife and sister, and we want to understand that relationship to understand how relationships with equals are accomplished or carried out. To go into that, we have to go into something that isn't how these things are accomplished. And it is one of those disgusting misunderstandings or misinterpretations of a mystical fact that the speaker has encountered. By now you understand another rant is coming. And the rant is about the concept of soulmates. There are many ideas about what soulmates means, and the people who use them are usually the most vague about it. It's usually invoked to sanction or to legitimize what one desires in the first place. Now, for some, it goes back, if you're familiar with the Symposium by Plato, they talked about love. And who was the playwright that told the story about the being cut into halves? You remember, Dan?
It may have been Aristophanes.
Yes, I believe it was Aristophanes. And the idea is that we have all been split in half, and that we have another half running around, and that someday we run into that person, and they are our perfect complement. And since we identify ourselves as ourselves, we reunify with them physically, and everything is hunky-dory. Now, the Rosicrucian philosophy teaches that we are beings that have been divided. But the division is an internal division. It is a division of the application of the creative energy. And the creative energy goes in part into building and evolving the body. And depending on the polarity chosen in this particular life, the body turns out to be either male or female. The other part of the creative energy is used for spiritual development and spiritual advancement until the day that we can return to auto-generated bodies and the division of the sexes will be no longer necessary, not even psychologically, because we will be more total people, and in our totality we won't need a partner outside of us to complement and satisfy our psychological being. Don't ask me to repeat that sentence either. Gender is a matter of destiny. If we are not highly evolved, then we have certain lessons that we need. We make it imperative that we be one gender or the other. But usually, it is a matter of choice. We're not permanently one way or the other. But we develop one way, and then we realize we have other kinds of needs that can be better satisfied in another polarity, and then we're reborn in another polarity. We don't have another half running around outside of us. We do have a divine counterpart within us, which, because the etheric body is polarized opposite of the dense physical body, appears as our opposite. That is what we unite with when we consummate the alchemical wedding, and that is when we become whole people. So most of the people who do believe in soulmates believe that it is a divinely ordered thing, and that there's only one special someone, and they're meant for each other forever and ever. or at least until they find out things aren't so perfect and the next soulmate comes along. Now, with regard to this, there is an adage that marriages are made in heaven. And that's not a bad idea, because everything on earth is made in heaven. We participate creatively in that fabrication of the world in between rebirths. We are then divine creative forces. Everything that happens to us is divinely ordained because we as divinities have ordained it. Sometimes in this work, we work very closely with other people. Our character, who we are with our idiosyncrasies and the general nature of our character, we don't build that in a vacuum. There is almost no one that makes their character, their unique being, by themselves alone. We need each other, and we build our character with regard to other people. So if we work very, very closely with each other over many lives, we build things together. And in some cases, the co-building is so strong that we can't unfold little idiosyncrasies in ourselves until we have the other person that helped us build it. We see this all the time in relationships. We have these routines that we have with other people, and we get into that, you know, doing our partnership routine. So when we meet somebody like that, it is very, very important. So it seems like some people are divinely ordained to us and that they were meant to be, so it's easy to see how some people can misconstrue the whole idea of soulmates. In any case, we may be determined to be with someone because we have made it that way. But overall, we're seeking to be free. And the things that we do in voluntary freedom are the things that we cooperate on and work on, where each person comes together in freedom. The things that we have to do, that are mandatory, are things that we have been recalcitrant about. And the fact that we are destined to some things is probably more a matter of shame than it is a matter of pride, that we had to be forced into something before we would actually do it. The universal spirit develops free beings, and all of the creative evolution is designed to bring the most out of us, so that when we have freedom without dependency. There's a big difference between dependence and independence and interdependence. Interdependence is voluntary. Independence is like a cancer. It takes away from the general organism, and it gives nothing to it but waste. In independence, there is no flow between the individual and the rest of the cosmic participants. In dependence, we remain creatures and we have no freedoms. So interdependence is what we look for rather than dependence. So there is someone special for us according to our divine destiny. And it is to the best of our freedom, and it isn't that we have another half running around. All right, the rant is now completed. No, it's not quite. I have one case. It's a recent thing that just happened, and it's really sad. This woman, young woman, unmarried mother, still a teenager, I think, maybe 19 years old, something like that. She's a high school graduate. She came to me and she said, I have a child by this man, and we tried living together, but we fought all the time. So I moved back in with my mother. And then what happened is another very handsome young man came along and she took up with him. And she came to me and she said, what do I do? Do I go with the father or do I go with this other man? And I was not about to tell her what to do. So I made a list of 7 criteria and put them in order of importance, and I explained each of the criteria to her, and thought she understood it. And I said, think on these things and go home with a sheet of paper and write down what you how each of these two people fits the criteria. And so what happened was, I ran into her mother a few days later and I said, well, did she work on the criteria? She said, thank you so much, you did just the right thing. But the next day she went to a psychic and the psychic told her that this new handsome young man is her soulmate and what is she waiting for? Get with him. Even though... yeah. So now you see why the rant, I guess. Hera represents the divine counterpart, his true one within. And what it is meant to be, this is what is meant when somebody is both a wife and a sister. That is to say, they're made, metaphorically speaking, of the same blood. After all of the outer things have been taken care of, he sought her out. He was attracted to her, just as we are often attracted to people that appear to be excellent counterparts to ourselves. We are truly creative until we do complete the divine inner union. In all mythology, divine lovers are jealous of weakening distractions. Only the divine love can completely satisfy one. Someone without will never be able to do that. Now, at this point, you're probably asking yourself, what does this have to do with coevolution? And to answer that, we'll turn to astrology. Now, in this talk, we're trying to look at relationships between coevolutionary equals. And in astrology, there are 3 houses which designate relationships and interactions with others as equals. They are on the mandala, the 3rd house in Gemini, which is the relationship with brothers and sisters. The 7th house in Libra, which is the relationship in marriage, and the 11th house in Aquarius, which is the relationship of friendship. This is cosmological astrology. It applies somewhat to natal horoscopes and things like that, but we're talking more about an evolutionary astrology. So as we go forward through the zodiac, we arrive at greater and greater evolutionary ability, and in this case it means greater and greater freedom. The 3rd house is a house of brothers and sisters. Now, you can't make your brother and sister not be your brother or sister even if you disown them. This kind of relationship has a mandatory character about it. Even in the constellations that have pictorial parts to them, the 2 Gemini are pictured as twins and they're locked together, arm in arm. Gemini is also a sign of polarization, which describes a necessary attraction of opposites. So these are like one facet of the Zeus-Hera relationship. These things point to a co-evolutionary relationship with each other as humans. Ultimately, we cannot remove ourselves or others from the brotherhood of the human family, our co-evolutionary family. Our human interdependence is a fact. And if we are knowledgeable of that fact and work with it, we live by it. We're told, for example, in the Rosicrucian philosophy, that very often people are born into a family to fight it out with each other until they learn to love with each other. And if you have to sleep in the same bed as your brother or sister, you better have made some progress on that before you go to bed, because that, you know, doesn't work out so well otherwise. Limitation or necessity, like that of brothers and sisters, doesn't have to be onerous. It doesn't have to be irksome. It can be quite a positive thing. We can see necessity as a very good thing. For instance, if we see each and every other human being, or every being for that matter, but especially human beings, as necessary, it makes a difference. If the people especially that we most dislike, if we see them as necessary, it's very easy to accept them more and to be able to try to love them more. Because after all, each of us is a burgeoning copy of the universe. Each of us is the universe with a unique point of view. And if somebody is not part of that, if somebody is, so to speak, taken out of it or dropped out of it, it's something more devastating than putting together a picture puzzle and having one piece missing. Because what is missing is a whole point of view. So the necessity, like the necessity we have in brothers and sisters, is not a bad thing at all, provided that we learn to see that there is something good in all of the people that we necessarily have to be with, relatives, co-workers, or whatever. Now, in our interhuman interrelations here in the Western world, we find more volitional freedom in the seventh house. Now we've moved forward one pace, and we're seeing that our marriage partnership, Zeus and Hera, especially Zeus, the decision maker in this case, had no choice about being a brother to his sister, but he did have freedom of choice about being her husband. We also, if we have freedom, we also have unfreedom in the same relationships. Therefore, to sustain commitment with human beings, being as shallow and fickle as we are, especially for the protection of human, we have to have something that holds things together. Libra has Venus as its rulership, and Capricorn is exalted there. And those two things point to the things that are used to bind commitment so things don't fall apart. We can't have children running all around the streets. There has to be a proper nest for them to grow up in. When we act on a choice, it is an action. And the moment we enter into an action, we come under the law of action, which is another name for cause and consequence, or for action and reaction. When and as we become self-conscious, we are free agents. But once we act, even in freedom, we're subject to the law. However, it is through the law that we come to know ourselves. Because in reaction, there is perfect feedback. When we act subjectively. We do what we intend to do as well as we can intend to do it. And right now, that isn't always perfect. And in our subjectivity, we say, like we often hear, when we refer to somebody's feelings, we say, I didn't mean to do that. It means that the cause that we put into effect wasn't what was intended in the first place. So, what we're talking about here, one of the things that binds us together with partners rather than brothers and sisters is the law. In our case, human law as well as cause and consequence, because we are learning to govern ourselves. And human law is often very flawed, but it nonetheless is necessary. Even at that, there's tremendous amount of child support that is left unpaid. I don't know, I think I know more people that raise the children on their own without the child support than the people that I know that raise them with child support. We men are dogs, aren't we? All right. We are subjective in cause, and we don't become objective until consequence comes to us. And when we have the whole feeling or the whole understanding of an event or of a circumstance, and we can see it from cause to consequence and from consequence back to cause, we become objective. That's the way the law works. Our consequences return to us, and we see very clearly that it couldn't be any other way. But when we have put something into the law and we get perfect cosmic feedback, we understand ourself as a creative being. The self or the individuality is different than the personality. So we're talking about individuation. The seventh house is the house of individuality and of individuation. That activity is not merely mechanical. It is beyond that, which brings us to the other factor of the binding of a commitment. And that other factor is love. Through marriage or partnership, any kind of commitment that is true, we bind ourselves to the other person with love. The spouse, the partner, the counterpart for us is the doorway to the individuality. Our partner is the way we learn to see ourselves. Our partner is the bride or groom of the alchemical wedding. If you think about it, when you're unmarried, you can do whatever you want to do. You're a free person. But it's not the same thing. You don't have that feedback from the partner. But when you get married, when you enter any kind of union where there is commitment, where there is psycho-spiritual intimacy, what happens is you are allowing the other person to have a say in most of the main things in life. If somebody can open your mail, or if they can make appointments for you, Or if they can do any of those kinds of things, that softens you up. If they speak for you and things don't work if you don't allow it, you learn to listen. And the more that we learn to listen to our partners, to our spouses, the easier it is to learn to listen to the alchemical partner. And so marriage is a very important thing in that it brings that about, that self-knowing. The self-knowing through loving someone else and having them bring out things in us that we would never know are in us. We don't just marry something that is like us. We marry someone that is going to bring things out of us. They represent us in an externalized way. So, this opens the way again to individuation. It opens us at the same time to loving each and every individual in the same way that we love our spouse. It's much more important to be attached to someone for complete intimacy and complete commitment than it is to reason with somebody or to have argument with them. When you actually feel your way into each other's life, that's a very important thing. Okay, well, these are very little things about co-relationships with co-evolutionary relationships with equals as seen through Zeus and Hera. We'll get to the 11th house in Aquarius in just a few minutes, but for now we have to tie something up, loose ends that we have hanging, so to speak, which is ironically something too large to tie up. That's again another whole myth that I have spent sometimes several lectures speaking on. We have the union of Zeus with his other sister, Demeter. He had other sisters too, but Demeter is one that he had a union with. He never did with Hestia. This is mythical fragment that I'd like to look at in a little bit differently. I'd like to look at it in terms of its outcome instead of its structure. Little is said about how the union between Zeus and Demeter was consummated. There are no clear stories about how it happened. But there is universal agreement about the outcome of it. The outcome of it was the daughter Kore, who some people know as Persephone. Zeus was protective of Demeter, and he was even jealous of her other lovers. And she had quite a few of them because she was the earth goddess. An earth goddess, an earth goddess of fertility and productivity and things like that. In Rome, she was called Ceres, which is where our word cereal comes from. Persephone, or Kore, when she was a young maid, was abducted by Hades, and she was taken into Tartarus, where she was installed as the queen of the dead. When this happened, Demeter loved her, and she grieved her loss and searched the whole world over, and eventually she would allow nothing on earth to grow until she got her daughter back. This is a pretty serious situation, and it was a difficult situation because it pitted Zeus against his brother Hades, and it was a deadlock kind of situation. Finally, Hermes, Mercury, brokered an agreement between them. And the agreement was that Persephone would spend part of the year in the underworld as queen of the underworld, and part of the year as the daughter of the earth goddess above the world, in the upper world. And so everything flourished. Now some claim that this is a superstitious rationalization of the declinational cycle of the sun. Others see it as the myth that is behind the Eleusinian mysteries, the mysteries of Eleusis. The Orphics saw it as the cycle of rebirth. And their view of it, along with the view of the solar cycle, is very similar to the way we celebrate the solstices and equinoxes in our little prayer group here. They saw it that same way. They saw the sun rising and setting, going higher in the sky and lower, and the changes in the seasons at the same time. Now, this is a very, very big and complex story, which we have no possibility and I have no desire to go into, because I would be here probably the entire weekend still talking yet, because there's so much in it. But it treats the cycle of rebirth. Zeus and Demeter were brother and sister, and they were equals, but their natures were very different. Zeus represented heaven, Demeter represented earth. And so we're talking about a cycle of things going back and forth between heaven and earth, from the deep spiritual inner worlds to the gritty outer material world. Kore is a child of that union of the abstract and of the concrete. And that child goes through a cycle, the cycle that changes the whole earth, but at the same time changes and brings the individuality out. Now, if we choose to look at it as all one being, it's a pretty good description of a human going through the cycle of rebirth. We go back to our creative source, we find creative enthusiasm and creative love, and then we bring it back to the world to bring it to completion, and we learn all kinds of lessons, and more facets are brought out of our spiritual nature. And then the experiences from the material world are taken back up into the spirit, and they become part of the spirit then, and we are greater creators. It's a pretty good mythical story. I don't know if I can really say much more than that, but I want to say a little bit more about relations with coevolutionary equals. Defining them. For example, vertical relations are easy to describe. St. Paul says we're a little lower than the angels. The observation is made another way, that spiritually we're like the gods. We're creative beings. But biologically, we're like the animals. So we're a little lower than the angels and a little higher than the animals. It's pretty easy to get that kind of definition. But to get a whole definition of what we are, it requires self-knowledge. Self-knowledge in the Greek mystery school, one of the Greek mystery schools, that was one of the adages or watchwords or whatever you want to call it. It was nothi se otan, know thyself. So we want to look just a very little bit and how we know ourselves, how we become ourselves, so that we can give ourselves in equitable relationships with others in the co-evolutionary process. It's not an easy question to answer intellectually. And to live in knowledge of ourself is even more difficult. We said just a little bit before that we know ourselves in one way, through cause and consequence, through the perfect feedback. By their fruits ye shall know them, and what comes back to us are our fruits according to what we have put out. And we can look back and at ourselves and say, yeah, that's me. It's got the ring of me to it, whether it's right or wrong. Now, we can judge inwardly about our nature, but in our present evolutionary state, our apprehension of things inwardly is very subjective. Moreover, because much of our inner nature, the psychic part of it, the lower nature, is in the hands of part of our being that is adversarial to us. And to a large extent, we're blind of our own motivations. We intend to do good things, but we don't. The good that I would, I do not, but that which I would not, that do I, says St. Paul. It would be nice if we had perpetual intuition and we could know all the while what we really were at heart or what we are in spirit, and that way we'd never get confused, and we would never put things in the hands of the lower nature, which is a pretender. So this is a very difficult problem. How do we know ourselves and become ourselves? Even the attitudes we have about ourselves are the atmosphere in which the self develops. And they're problematic. Just think about it. We can't hate ourselves, because if we hate ourselves, we're not going to think well of ourselves, and we're not going to move forward in a healthy way. We're always going to be sickly beings. On the other hand, if we love ourselves, that's the classic definition of vanity. And the more we try to love ourselves, the more it increases the vanity. Love is supposed to come from us. Love is to go to others. It's not to come from ourselves to ourselves, which is something like a psycho-spiritual masturbation. So when you hear all these people talking, oh, you just have to love yourself. That's sounds nice, but it doesn't find consonance with reality. Personally speaking, in this issue, I try to be cognizant of the fact that I am loved by God. And the fact that I'm loved by God, and that ever so much is given to me, as ever so much is given to every one of us, seems to be more than sufficient. The love, just realizing the love that comes to us, makes us want to do more. We feel good, we get enthusiasm. And it makes us want to love others more. We want others to feel the same way. I benefit from others loving me, and that makes me want to love others more. If we are loved from outside of ourselves, perhaps we can get to self-knowledge. But we have to be very careful that we're not too self-centered, because self-centeredness is something that denies love. So, we said before, we can learn a lot by our fruits, by what comes out of us, who we associate with, what our effect on them is, do they want to become better people, and so on. There is objectivity to that, but that's very indirect. We want something that is on both the cause and consequence side of the equation. We want to do good things, and we want to do it knowingly. We don't want to have to wait until the effect comes back, then we can see whether we did well or not. And to do that, we have to know ourselves, and we have to know what we are capable of. Combining the inward approach and the outward approach, it's a better way of looking at love about ourselves, but it's still fragmentary. It would be wonderful if we could completely step outside of ourselves and do, as Bobby Burns said, "Oh, would some God the gifty give us to see ourselves as others see us, especially if the others were the gods themselves." Now, in our temple service, our little Rosicrucian temple service that we do every week, we say, "Then we shall know even as we are known." This is implied that there is a way of being known totally. And it also implies that we will be known in whole and not in part. And that's what we're looking for with self-knowledge. Now, the problem of self-knowledge is not parochial. Every spiritual path has to contend with it. And a good number of different approaches have evolved. Some try to destroy the self, which merely strengthens the self. Even trying to contain it too much strengthens it. It strengthens not only the self, it strengthens the personal ego, the false self. If it were successful and our consciousness had no identity, no individuality, the salt would have lost its savor. And that would be blasphemously contrarian. I find it exceedingly hard to believe that all of the divine hierarchies over the millions and millions of years gave so much of themselves to bring us to the point where we have a divine self, and to do that only for us to try to destroy it, that's kind of a sick reasoning. It doesn't make any sense to me. Other schools have had other views about the problem. But as I understand it, and I'm not trying to be partisan here, I'm trying to be philosophically accurate, I think the view of Christian mysticism is optimal. It may even be singular. According to the view of Christian mysticism, the self, the true spiritual ego, is an idea. It's a divinely conceived idea. It is a divinely sustained idea as long as there are ideas. It is, in fact, located, the human spirit, the third focus of our threefold spirit, which is the seat of the self, is located in the region of abstract or ideational thought. And there's nothing there but ideas. And all of them, because it is transcendental, all of them are divine. The entire world of thought, abstract and concrete, is precipitated from life spirit. And life spirit is pure, unconditioned, and unconditional truth, among other things. It's so unconditioned that in the East it's called the void, meaning to say that it's void of any kind of condition or any kind of description that you can put on it in the way that we do in our human spheres, which are well below that. The ideas, including the idea of self, are limited expressions of truth. They are truths within truth. Truth is universal, it's pure, and it transcends, even though it fulfills the truths. States of pure spirit, beyond ideas, come to manifest objectivity by reflecting off of their selfhood, reflecting off of this lens mirror in the terrible diagram. So, these ideas, including the idea of self, are expressions of truth. States of pure truth transcend. Now, if we come from the other direction, at our highest, we are aware of ourself when we are awake in the idea of self, and that self is, as such, called, that self-awareness is called a baptism by the Holy Spirit, though not all things that go by that name are that experience. But we are still within ourselves. Even when we have a baptism of the Holy Spirit, the what is called Savikalpa Samadhi in the East, when we are in that, we still have an individual point of view. And we're still within self. And in order to be the perfect loving beings we want to be able to get beyond self, beyond opinion, beyond viewpoint. We don't want to get rid of them because our viewpoints are important. Without our viewpoints, the universe suffers. Now, since the world of life spirit is the realm of Christ, to transcend self is to transcend to life spirit. And this can be done without destroying self. That is, we can be aware of our selfness and of all other selfnesses in the nature of, or in the being of, the life spirit. Since the life spirit is the world of Christ, the process of transferring consciousness to the life spirit is called giving one's self to Christ. There is an image that goes back to the Exodus in the Old Testament of the Bible, and it was very common in the Greek mystery schools, and it's very helpful for getting a picture, provided you don't cling to the picture. If we imagine an ocean with no top, no bottom, no shore, but an ocean of fluidic, boundless love light. And then imagine an eddy or a whirlpool in that ocean. The eddy is an empty nothing. But at the same time that it is an empty nothing, it defines the ocean, which is otherwise boundless and undefined. This eddy, as it defines itself, defines the ocean to the ocean itself. It makes a difference of a being, a thing. All things were made by it. Within being, it is a real thing and illusory at the same time. Though the greater reality is obviously the ocean, our individuality is still a reality, a temporary reality, because eddies don't last. In this analogy, our waking self-consciousness, even if we are having a baptism of the Holy Spirit, or that kind of, which is called Savikalpa Samadhi, our consciousness is in the whirlpool. And the deeper our concentration, the more defined the whirlpool is, and the more definite the reality that we have. We know this when we concentrate deeply. When we concentrate deeply, we set everything spinning. We can see it and feel it. We are in it. The process of giving oneself to Christ is changing the focus of attention from the whirlpool to the ocean, from the self to selfness. And our existence wouldn't be without the ocean, so this is possible. So when we see ourselves as others see us, when we know as we are known, when we are known perfectly and totally, it is changing that frame of reference or that point of reference. You can carry the image much further, because this means that there are whirlpools throughout the ocean. And some of those whirlpools are within other whirlpools. And if you can hold this in your consciousness, it is, you are imagining something that is something like a reflection of the life of life spirit. It's alive in every direction and dimension without any kind of bound. It's filled with vivid life. It's bristling with life. It is overflowing with life. And it is overflowing with selfness. So, we can see that this is what we're looking for. Because once we see this, when we're looking from the viewpoint of the ocean, we are in union with that which unites every other whirlpool, so to speak. That brings us back to Aquarius and the 11th house. The 7th house and Libra are the house and sign of loving a specific one. We give ourselves to that specific one, and we learn and know about ourselves through that other person. The 11th house and Aquarius are the house and sign that are universal. The infinite other. The light that is the light of knowing without even having a specific thing to know. And the knowing lovingly brings things into existence. And because it's unconditioned, it's unconditional. And we know that when we look at Aquarian ways of doing things. Friendship is Aquarian. And this is friendship for anyone and everyone. We have learned to love each specific one through the 7th house. Now we carry that to the love that is between all of the selves, and putting our consciousness in that, we automatically love everyone. That doesn't obviate having personal or individual relationships. They can exist within that greater love. We might have something very special to do with one whirlpool or another. Friendship love is unconditional. We would do anything for the sake of friendship. There's no thought of self. Of course, to do this is a difficult thing. Very, very few altruists exist in the world. And egoism runs rampant. And some people believe that egoism is what makes the world go. But little by little, we have to give up personal attachment and personal motivation, and we have to find it in others. This is stated in that lovely Bible verse, love thy neighbor as thyself. Meaning to say yourself isn't you, yourself is in the other, any other and every other. It's doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's still under cause and consequence. But loving your neighbor as yourself, you know, we all do love ourselves a little too much. We have to do that. And because we know this, we have to do it now. And that's really hard. Because when you start living for the sake of the other and for the sake of the all, you can't really protect yourself. To the degree that you protect yourself, you get drawn back into egoism again. And there are enough people out there when they say, oh, here's a sucker, we can really wham him, and that's what happens. We can't wait until everybody else does it, or it'll never be done. We just have to, you know, what did they say? Bite the bullet. This is the way that is in the changing, sliding relationships with equals. This is the way of the future. This is the way inaugurated by Christ Jesus. And if we want to have healthy relationships, despite the personal pain that we may have to take in getting to that, we have to trust that it's going to be all right. We just have to go ahead and do it. This is what we have to learn to do. When we do it, it's a wonderful thing. But we can't do it for the bliss and the joy of it, because if we do it for the bliss and the joy of it, we're self-centered again. This is why at the very end in St. John's Gospel, there are all of those beautiful, beautiful things that Christ says. You have called me master, but henceforth I call you friends. Greater love hath no man than he lay down his life for his friends. And the big one is, ye are my friends. We'll close with the Rosicrucian Student's Prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Probably a little more churchy than you were expecting.
Not necessarily. Okay. The secret society we belong to does churchy things too.
Okay. We did it.
All right.
It was a long week.
Thank you for the thought.
Oh, I should turn the cooler back on.
So I lost my best friend on the summer solstice 47 years.
Oh, this was the lady that used to be the farm woman?
No, she's still alive. This is my friend way out in Winter, Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
And so, but, you know, I shopped for her. I did all kinds of things for her because she lived in this tiny little town. And talked to her most days, and so I really miss her.
Okay.
And I was just looking. See, when you look at my...
Oops.
...at my chart... friend and
just a second,
and so forth category. Excuse me. Now, is this the head of the dragon or the tail?
It's the tail.
The tail? Okay, and I don't know how that has to do with friendship. And this is the Neptune is what I have in.